Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 36. Today on the show, I have Angus Ross, physiologist and strength expert working with High Performance Sport New Zealand. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the FreeLap timing system, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the SpeedMat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The FreeLap timing system has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches, training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology. All right, welcome back for another episode of the Just Fly Performance Podcast. I'm your host, Joel Smith, and this is episode 36. Today on the show, we have Dr. Angus Ross, amazing guest. I'm so excited to get to the conversation that him and I had. And first time I had actually heard of Angus was through Stu McMillan's blog and a post that Angus wrote regarding eccentric training and some of the concepts therein. Being familiar with the K-Box in particular and all the eccentric benefits that that brings, it was of particular interest to me because I've used it with a lot of athletes, and just to kind of see how he defines it and its potential benefits and uses is just really interesting. He's got a great both a base of research and then practical application, how he's using it with athletes. So that's what we're going to spend a lot of time talking about today. And if you're not familiar with eccentric training very simply is, and when we're talking in the scope of strength training largely here, not so much plyometrics, but strength training that elicits maximal eccentric or lengthening, muscle lengthening adaptations. So things like, say, doing two legs up, one leg down on a squat or a leg press, utilizing the K-Box where the flywheel will do that eccentric overload for you, make the way down very difficult, using weight releasers and other similar methods. So just a quick definition there if you weren't familiar. We also are going to talk about a few other topics that I've seen in one of his just incredible presentations that's floating around the internet somewhere in a slideshow where he chats about things like chasing weight room numbers, building rate of force development, training the feet, and more. If you're interested in building speed, building jumping ability, this is just an awesome, awesome episode. Angus does have a track and field background, and in his role being employed by High Performance Sport in New Zealand, he works with a lot of like Olympic type sports that speed and power does define that result. So you're going to see just a lot of that in his answers today. Some of the quotes that you'll see in the show notes are ones that have altered or confirmed some of the things that I've kind of thought about for a long time as a coach. And one of the biggest one is specifically the overshoot and the cortical recruitment or mental recruitment of eccentric training. It's really fascinating. And eccentric training is definitely becoming more popular. And so Angus shows us how to use it well. And you're going to see some things actually coincide with former guest Cal Dietz and what some things he was talking about. So let's get on to the show. We have episode 36 with Angus Ross. All right, Angus, welcome to the show today. Thanks so much for being here with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. It'll be good. Hopefully we get some good information and some of it's useful. And you can understand my accent too, I guess, would be the other question.
Yeah, absolutely. I can hear you loud and clear, man. It's great to have an accent on this show. I need more people with an accent on this radio show. So in that regard, man, it's awesome. Could you start out by sharing with us your background in the field and how you got to where you are now?
Okay, so yeah, I mean, I started off in track and field as a very mediocre athlete, I guess you could say, and I had an interest in speed power. I was doing some multi events type decathlon and what have you, and got an opportunity to do bobsleigh because it suited probably what the gifts I did have probably were suited to that. And then I did bobsleigh for a number of years, which sort of gave me a long interest in the speed power stuff. In the conjunction with doing that, I was doing postgraduate study and did a PhD whilst I was doing bobsleigh. I guess that gave me some IP and understanding of what I was doing, why I was doing it. And then from there, have gone on to work. Firstly, I did my postgrad study in Australia. So I worked within the Australian Academy system at QAC, Queensland Academy of Sport, and then on to the Australian Institute of Sport. And then I've returned back to New Zealand and have been working in the New Zealand sort of high performance system for the last 10 years or so.
Awesome. Yeah, I think I kind of maybe share that common bond with you. I was a track and field athlete looking myself, trying to look for ways to be as fast and strong as my peers who were a lot more gifted than I am. So I definitely can identify with you on that point.
Yeah, yeah.
So first official question on the show is, what's your take on eccentric training for building jumping or sprinting ability? So eccentric resistance training particularly.
Yep, look, I think eccentric resistance training is a modality which has a lot of advantages. You might have seen that stuff I've done for Stu McMillan on his blog, and I think it offers a lot of opportunity. It's probably the one modality where you can, that we've shown increases in fiber type or fast twitch fiber and cross-sectional area simultaneously. There's no other training modality, and I've been looking at this stuff, in the research for 20 years that I've seen, that has offered that. Typically when we do resistance training, we get a shift away from the fastest myosin, the 2X myosin, the contractile protein within muscle, and we get a shift towards the more fatigue-resistant 2A, which may, impair the contractile speed of the muscle. Fast eccentric training has offered that ability to develop this fast contractile property. So I think in that respect, for sprinting, jumping, we've got constrained timeframes for force application. There's some very real advantages there. And I guess not only that, there's the stretch shortening cycle, the stiffness of a muscle or a leg spring can be positively enhanced with it. But that said, you need to have a rationale for an athlete that you're using it with. And I've found, and just this is purely anecdotal, but if you have an athlete that's a very stiff athlete already in a sprinted jumper scenario, the adaptations may not be as favorable as if you have what I would call a very compliant or a floppy type athlete that has enormous range of movement, powerful, but spends a lot of time on the ground. That athlete typically seems to go very, very well with eccentric training, and you may get some very positive adaptations from it, which you may not necessarily see in the other guy. Horses for courses, I guess.
Interesting. Yeah, I was going to ask you which athletes might be more well suited for that type of training. So you're saying the really like kind of floppy, more stiff, or I guess maybe like the swimmer type particularly would be example.
Exactly. Over the top version in track and field terms, you want, most of our guys are quite, have quite good leg spring stiffness, but you do have one or two. I had a hurdler a couple of years ago that was extremely mobile, very good hurdler, raw speed, not as good as their hurdling ability, but with eccentric training, they got some very positive adaptations in their ability to run fast, and thus their hurdle results went up as well. So yeah, some real good adaptations there.
Okay, great. So it's almost like it almost fills the gap then for people who are a little more compliant and need to tighten everything up a little bit. That's where it kind of fills the gap as special strength.
Yeah. So that's one aspect of it. But also, I think most people could benefit from improving their fiber composition, if you like. And with the right program, I think you can get adaptations in that space. I guess you need to... Eccentric training will also do damage, and it will compromise other training units. And you need to build it into your periodization, allowing for perhaps a depression of performance initially, and allowing for time for that for them to rebound, taper the training, and show some real positive adaptations down the track. And one of the things I see is people will try it. Oh, I got worse. That doesn't work. Well, you need to have a plan. And so, if you haven't got a plan, it's going to fail. And you need to realize what it's going to do, when it's going to do it, what my time frame is for super compensation. And there's a lot of literature out there on it. That blog post I had for Stu is probably not a bad place to start to understand some of that stuff. But yeah, it's all out there, and not many people use it as well as they could, would be my suggestion. But that affords opportunities for those that do.
Yeah, absolutely. So when would you say is a good time, like, that an athlete's ready for this type of training? So at what, like, kind of level in both the long-term development, like, you know, high school, yep, up to collegiate and 20, you know, in their 20s, and then what time of maybe I'll start with that question, actually.
Yeah, so I would say I may be a little conservative on that. Some coaches will just use it as soon as possible. I would say keep it in your toolkit for when they've got through that natural progression of, you know, 16, 17, 18, 19, and they're going to get bigger, stronger, faster, regardless of what they do, pretty much. Get through that, where you're starting to get blunted adaptations, and then it might be another booster that you might use for somebody that's been training a few years. It wouldn't be my first port of call for the novice athlete, put it that way. I would say once I've got a few years training under their belt, then look at it as an adaptation to keep bolstering those adaptations.
Yeah, it's kind of like an ace in your sleeve in the card game. You're using it kind of at the last moment, once everything else is kind of gone run its course then.
Yeah. I mean, it's not necessarily the last thing, but you know, there's lots of things that we use, you know, whether you start supplementation with creatine or any other, you know, sort of vaguely ergogenic supplement, or, you know, you try, different recovery modalities. This is another modality, another trick to your toolkit that you can use. Yeah, but and it wouldn't be the first one that I would use.
Yeah, I probably worded it wrong by saying it's the last thing. That does sound bit like, oh, it's the last thing you'd use. I'm sure what's an athlete's ready for it in those types of things. When is a good, like, time of the season? You had mentioned, and I thought this was really fascinating or interesting, because it definitely made sense to me when you said it, but that your performance might decrease right away because of the intensity of the stimulus. So is that something you would kind of use in, like, a general training block before you would get into the more competitive time of season? Or when's the best time of the year to be looking at using some of this overloaded eccentric work?
Yeah, absolutely. I would be using it in a preparatory period, not during competition. I think in competition you'll find exactly that. It does depress your performance. With concentric contractions, as we get to a faster contraction, the force goes down. Or the opposite occurs with eccentric. You can have a really fast, high force eccentric contraction, and so the stress on the muscle was huge. And, you know, with that in mind, the damage and the recovery time goes up accordingly. You get soreness. You know, we know that the fascia gets damaged. You get soreness in the fascia even, and then, you know, your proprioception might be a bit funny. It'll interfere with your technical work. It'll interfere with your speed work. So, if you do it in season, you're in a world of hurt, because it will compromise performance. That said, if you do it, you know, weeks and weeks out, we know that there tends to be positive adaptations down the line. And the other thing with eccentric training is you detrain from it much more slowly than you detrain from concentric training. So you might find that you can do a block of eccentric training in your off season for a jumper, for example, and then they could go down to one session a week in season and still maintain all of those strength adaptations, because, yeah, that they have this long detraining period anyway, and it doesn't take much to maintain it. So, I think it's a really good tool, but optimizing the use of it, we still don't know how to do that fully, but it's, and there's a lot of people, a lot of PhDs in the world doing it, looking at it right now. And, I'm lucky I've got a couple of students that are working in that space also. So, we're hoping we develop some good IP in that area.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster. Oh, that's great. Yeah, I'm excited to see how that research comes along for you. That's awesome. Two more last questions on the whole eccentric world of things. The first one is so the modality, a lot of people listening, not only coaches, but probably athletes too, looking What's like a practical, some practical recommendations on like a single session? How are you utilizing this with the barbell?
Yeah, so there's it's quite hard to do in practical terms without the right equipment, but we do a lot of partner push down, so they do concentrically drive it up a normal like a normal iso inertial load, like you might have a squat, and we'll be pushing down on the eccentric phase, so they're getting an eccentric overload. You can do that with squats, bench press, hip thrusts, whatever modality you're using. All the standard ones, using two legs up, one leg down. What else we use? Weight releases, so that they're just doing singles or need something on each end to put the weight releases back on. You know what weight releases are? You familiar with those? So we do quite some sessions with those. But there's also some commercial modalities. I mean, we talked earlier about K-box or some of those other ones which have eccentric elements in them. Kettlebell swings with the partner, throwing the kettlebell on the eccentric phase, you're overloading that phase. I mean, you're limited by your imagination, really. There's a lot of area. You can do them in upper body exercises with, somebody pushing down on the weight stack while they're doing the eccentric phase or whatever it might be. Somebody else pushing down with their leg on the weight stack, so you're getting excessive overload. We've played with a lot of different crazy ideas, which, and if you go overboard, you'll get soreness. But I think probably just to throw in there too, with eccentric training, there's a very real protective effect of prior sessions. So if you need to start off conservatively, first couple of sessions, and then you can start ramping it up. The temptation is, because the metabolic cost of that eccentric stuff is quite low, well, this is quite easy. I'm coping with this quite well, and then you can't walk for a week, and so you need to start off conservatively and gradually increase that stress.
Getting out of bed the next morning could be pretty rough. I've gotten some swimmers who I put way too much in the system early on, pretty sore. Using it early on. The question I had for you, and I like how you brought up the two legs up, one leg down. I feel like that's a really easy way to do it. And yeah, we were talking about doing that on the K box before, and yeah, just super easy.
Definitely.
So how long, what are some block lengths of how long you would use this type of stuff in like a preparatory period? Like, I'm sure it's variable by sport and athlete and level, but kind of as a general, would you say maybe 3 to 6 weeks, or what type of length
I
of
think that's
stimulus?
probably reasonable. We've sort of Some of the athletes have moved to doing 2 weeks on, 1 week off, because it is quite a stressful stimulus, and they need that week off. So others have ground through 3 weeks on. We might start with, a slower eccentric contraction and then move to a faster eccentric contraction in the next 3 weeks, just so there's a change in stimulus. I think with senior athletes that have been training for a while, you need to you can't just keep grinding away at the same stuff. So 6 weeks of the same stuff would be excessive with eccentric training, just because of the intensity of it, I think. I'm happy to be proven wrong, but in my experience, that's probably the case here.
6 weeks could make sense. I was actually today I was just reading one of Bondarchuk's new books. He was talking about his developmental cycles and how long it takes the athlete to like wire in the skill, and I think it was like 5 to 8 weeks or something like that. It kind of
Yeah, I think with eccentric training, that's tough to go that long and continuously. I know that one angle, but yeah, if you change the stimulus or the eccentric speed or something in that period, sure. But if you just ground away at, the same eccentric exercise for 6 weeks, I think you'd be pretty stale of it by that time, I would think. So yeah, shorter blocks where you're changing it somewhat regularly is probably a good option, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 6 weeks in a row, the same thing would definitely beat you up. It'd be like Nelio Mora talking about, and hopefully we can kind of touch on this type of thing later on the podcast, but when you do max strength for too long, it makes you stale. It's almost like eccentric would be like a highway to that if you did it too much
Exactly.
too long.
Well, yeah, that's right. And the eccentric stuff gets greater cortical activation than anything else. And yeah, so whether it's a that affects the how quickly you get started, I don't know, but I suspect that it would be quite hard mentally to keep getting up for that eccentric stuff for 6 weeks in a row would burn you, unless you changed it somehow.
Cool. So, like cortical, you mean, like mental power too. Could you explain that just a little bit? That's kind of interesting to me as well.
So the random thing about eccentric training is that there's greater levels of you know, cortical activation measured in the brain. So the motor cortex, there's higher levels of activation in that during eccentric training than there is with concentric training. The contrast to that is at the muscle level, there's less activation at the muscle with eccentric training and greater activation with concentric training. So it's almost like there's some inhibition at the spinal cord level, and maybe training eccentrically limits that spinal cord inhibition, then you're able to express this eccentric force better subsequently in a jump or a triple jump when you're having massive eccentric forces in a triple jump, 22 times body weight, whatever it gets up to. Maybe that eccentric training limits some of that inhibition. You can apply more force more quickly, you jump further. I don't know. That's kind of makes sense in my mind. Not sure that's making sense to anybody else, but
it totally makes sense. I could resonate with that in my own, my old man training. Well, not old man training, but I'm, at 33 masters level, I'm not really competing at track meets. But the last couple of weeks, I've been starting up an eccentric training regimen and doing some sprinting, and my performance has been steadily going down. I'm not sore at all. It's just I'm just like mentally sluggish. My tap test is down, and I think it's just the brain. It's sucking the part of my brain, but hopefully in a few weeks I'll super compensate and be good to go.
Yeah, well, there's certainly studies that show that eccentric training can induce reductions in force output for weeks and weeks and weeks if you smash the hell out of it. And inadvertently, some eccentric training studies have shown almost that you take time off from the eccentric stimulus. I think there's a paper by Leong, Jim Martin's lab in Utah, and they had, I forget the time frame, but it might have been 8 or 12 weeks with no eccentric stimulus, and their power went up. This detraining window, and or they got over the depression of the eccentric stimulus, and then, that's months later, they were doing sort of personal best power levels, which is kind of interesting that it is this modality that has long-term implications for your performance. So you don't want to periodize it in 2 weeks before nationals because you're going to be cooked. So you need to plan it as how you're going to use it. Otherwise, it can be a disaster.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's almost like you think of it as it's an advanced tool in the hands of a coach that can use it well, and it can be an amazing, amazing weapon for performance. But if used haphazardly because it's the latest trend, it could... Yep. You bite you in the ass pretty well when you want to do well.
Absolutely.
That's an awesome way of putting it. Yeah, very cool. Cool. So moving on a little bit, you talked, I believe, a little bit about something with the adaptations with the fascia when you were discussing eccentric training. So could you talk a little bit about training and the response of the tendons and fascia, and maybe specifically for the world of building like static spring ability, so sprinting and jumping and those types of things?
With regard to eccentric training or just in general?
Just fascia and tendons in general. Yeah. If you wanted to talk eccentric training too, that would be great. I guess I just probably magnified the question a little bit. But maybe first... sorry, go ahead.
I'm certainly wouldn't claim to be the world expert on this, but we know that eccentric training and even isometric training, high loads do develop tendon cross-sectional area. And we know that eccentric training will develop stiffness of a whole leg spring, if you like, which probably relates to fascial thickness integrity as well as muscle adaptation. So I think it is because of the ability to get very high tensions, it is a very strong stimulus for that spring, if you like. If you just do isometric training, which is probably one of the more popular modalities now with tendon rehab, certainly. I don't know. I think you need to do some. You almost can develop a strong but sluggish, tendon with lots of hysteresis. In my mind, it doesn't stretch much, it doesn't rebound much. You still need to do some dynamic elastic work in conjunction with or following that. Once you've developed this tendon or structure with good integrity, then you need to go out and bounce it, make it work as a spring again, because I think and maybe that's a motor pattern thing. I'm not sure if it's the tendon properties per se, but certainly that's my experience, that just doing that stuff is not enough. You need to use it in a plyometric fashion for a period of time to optimize those gains. I don't know if that's probably clear as mud, but yeah, that's kind of the way I think of it anyway. And you may have some questions on how I'm just explaining that, but yeah.
Yeah, no worries. So kind of what I got from that was like just doing like purely isometric training, you're just involving the frictional elements of muscle. You're not involving the tendons, and also you need to include more of the plyometric and the dynamic work. Or was there more than that to follow?
Well yeah, you're still developing tendon with isometric work. You still can get gains in cross-sectional area, but I think you need to learn to use it elastically as well. So you need phases. If you're going to do that, an eccentric might be a little bit the same, especially slow controlled eccentric. I put that in the same boat probably in my mind as isometric work. You're developing this good integrity of the tissue, but subsequent to that, before you get into a competitive situation, you need to be doing some training where you're doing rapid bouncing, if you like, plyometrically sprinting, jumping, whatever it is, throwing, whatever your modality is, to facilitate that being useful.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster. Sure. So the isometric, or maybe even like the slower lifting type stuff, it strengthens the tendon, but it doesn't build it elastically. It is that more of a...
That's my, take on it. Yeah.
Okay.
That's probably
the yeah, sure. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that's certainly something that a lot of people need to consider when they're doing like just, you know, general regular strength training and then looking for transfer and special strength and those types of things. Yeah, so speaking of strength as well, and this is something that I probably find myself thinking about this at least once a week, as kind of the chicken and the egg mentality when it comes to, you know, speed power athletes and maximal strength levels in the weight room. And so yeah. The question I have for you is strength, is training a maximal strength ability in an athlete a critical element, or is it merely like a byproduct of they're already an incredibly powerful athlete, so they can lift a particular weight? Like, how does that cycle work? Oh yeah, super. I opened up Pandora's box on this question. It's a difficult.
Yeah, one. I mean, who's got the answer to that? Not me. I think there's a bit of both. You know, I think we know that in sprinting, for example, you might have 100 milliseconds to produce force. So having a bigger strength reserve tends to be good for rate of force development. But at some point, doing boatloads of strength training, particularly traditional strength training, will give you a slower muscle rather than the faster muscle. So you'll end up by being married to the weight room, if you like. You'll get those initial gains. Novice gets a bit stronger, they tend to go faster. And people go, oh, cause and effect. But in actual fact, what they might have done, they got to the level of strong enough, if you like. They developed a slightly stiffer muscle that was reactive. And then they kept on training, and that was good. And then they kept on training and training, and they started developing a slightly slower muscle. And they were already strong enough, and that compromises adaptation. So to go back to your question, yes, I think some of our elite jumpers that we see huge numbers for, they can do those huge numbers, and they don't have to do the work that, you know, Joe Average would have to do to power clean 150 kilos, for example. And we've all heard of Jonathan Edwards, you know, his amazing strength numbers. But the guy, I'm sure, was an exceptional talent that probably did that on, you know, 2 to 3 sessions a week in the gym, whereas a normal person might need to do 5 or 6, and would end up, he could do it, and he probably didn't, because he was doing such a limited volume, didn't compromise his fiber type or his, you know, contractile speed, whereas somebody else may have to do more of that sort of diesel training to get to that point and wouldn't get the performance benefits that he enjoyed, if you like.
Yeah, it's almost like I've heard it put the way of... you know, chasing or getting those numbers isn't wrong. It's how you choose to get there. If you're, you know, it's
exactly right. Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah. And some people can get there quite easily, and it's not necessary, as you say, it's not necessarily that what makes them a great jumper. It's their genetic coding that makes them able to get there easily. Is that, you know, goes hand in hand with that, and that is why they're a great jumper. Not necessarily, you know, it helped, but it wasn't the only thing.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think some like practical guidelines are for looking at that line, like where you think you're approaching how strong you might need to be, or how much effort you're putting in to create you attaining these max strength levels? Are there any kind of suggestions for the creating the balance there?
Yeah, I'm always wary of that sort of question. Like, you kind of must power clean 1.5 times body weight or whatever rule of thumb somebody might have. I don't. What's good for you won't be good for me, or vice versa. And some people can do a lot of strength training and not compromise their speed. Other people do more than 2 sessions a week and they get slow. And so, yeah. It's an experimental thing. It's an N of one, for each individual needs to try it for themselves. We're all going to make mistakes. And coaches get a good eye for it. I'm sure if you mentioned some of the coaches you've had on here, they would have a very good eye for, well, look, we need to pull back on that a bit. You're starting to compromise. I can see the quality of your takeoffs is getting worse or whatever. Sorry, I haven't got a good answer for you on that. Sorry.
No, I think you actually answered pretty well with what you said, in that some athletes are, if they do more than twice a week, that's they're going to start eliciting these adaptations that aren't, fast twitch elastic. And throughout all the guests I've had on the podcast, that kind of resounding thing, and yet I keep asking these general questions, is it depends, it's individualized. But absolutely, I mean, and when I was coaching track, I would often just do 2 lifting sessions a week just to kind of be on the safe side. But it seems like in a lot of college settings, it's, well, we do three, or a lot of settings we do three, not just college here, but just because it's Monday, Wednesday, Friday, it's symmetrical, so we should lift every day and that type of
And I think people
mentality.
have got to get onto not being afraid of doing less. Like, strength is an add-on. It's not jumping or sprinting is what you're training for. And I guess and it seems to be a lot of, when I go to the US, people like the gym. They like doing weights. They like getting strong. That's not the only way to do it, is my take on it. Maybe I'm wrong, but there's some athletes that we're working with that we get down to 1 session a week and they still go well off that, and they have more time to do the technical elements of their event. And I think that's worth considering too. If you're not able to cope with this massive training load, maybe you move away from it. Maybe that's the way you're built. So you need to be able to experiment with the different options there.
Yeah, oh, I absolutely agree with you on that one, Angus. Totally. This is another offshoot. The next question I have for you, it's maybe it's along the lines of eccentric training a little bit. Well, actually, it is. Or maybe the fast eccentric training. But what are your thoughts on doing like drop catch training in the weight room, or ballistic work, where you're dropping a weight and catching it quickly, or those types of fast, very fast movements? And what do you think the role is there for building jumping power, for instance?
Well, look, I think that there's some, definitely good role for those sort of exercises. I guess, from my perspective, you've got to kind of go back to mechanistically what you're trying to achieve with that. And if it's, catching something very suddenly, you're getting a lot of rate of force development at a given joint angle, for example. Is that applicable to your event, sport? Yes, no. Therefore, is it a good idea? But yeah, as you say, quite often that rapid eccentric spike you get from that sort of exercise will have some positive adaptations, and what they might be will relate to those things we discussed earlier. Fiber type, rate of force development, stiffness, elastic properties, etc. So I think there's definitely a place for them. But I always want to have a rationale for why I'm using something, and so I kind of try and go back to. And sometimes it just works, and you're trying to reverse engineer a rationale out of it. But I would kind of like to have some concept behind it if I was using it.
Yeah, definitely. Just knowing what you're trying to get out of it, not just because you saw it on the internet or social media and it looked awesome. Like having a greater understanding.
Exactly.
On the flip side of that, what's your thoughts on the value of concentric only based strength training? So doing barbell work, or say a squat from a dead rack start, like a half squat from the bar resting on the rack and exploding up, those types of movements, almost the polar opposite.
To me, I can see in some sports where that's useful. Like I had a bobsleigh background. If you come from a stat, some teams started from a very static start, therefore you need to train that specifically. In a block start, you come from a static position, and if you were training at those joint angles to be a 60-meter runner and you wanted to explode from that, you know, 90, 120 knee angles you might be working on, sure, I could see that. Beyond that, I struggle to see how it's particularly useful. But that's not to say it isn't. That's just my inexperience with it as a modality, maybe. But it doesn't seem to be a great rationale. We know that the adaptations from concentric only versus eccentric only are markedly inferior in most aspects. You know, developing cross-sectional area, shifting of the fiber type to a faster or slower contractile protein, eccentric wins every time. And so, yeah, I'm yet to see a case from somebody that makes it very valid to me, unless it's for one of those very specific elements, a block start, specific type training, or a, you know, an isometric start in bobsleigh or whatever it might be. Yeah.
Sure. So would you say outside of the traditional weightlifting tempos we prescribe, like say, you know, a second up, a second down, or 2 seconds down, explode up, like eccentric is kind of the main you know, variation off that, and then some of the other ones are maybe a little bit less useful for the majority of athletes interested in sprinting and jumping, those things?
Yeah, I think probably that's my current understanding. You know, obviously you're always open to learn and find out new things, but yeah, I'm not a massive advocate. I mean, you could say that people would say, oh, maybe, well, am I writing off Olympic lifting, for example, is coming from it's concentric only in the pull phase, but I think it's highly dynamic and there's an eccentric catch, so it's not purely. So I wouldn't be classing an Olympic lift in that fashion either. So I'm not writing off Olympic lifting, if that's what.
Sure.
You could take that too, I suppose.
Sure, sure, no doubt. I mean, I'm sure. I know there's a lot of you know, a lot of amazing athletes who do without anything really or any specific type of thing in the weight room, but yeah, definitely understandable. I think you can make those arguments even for Olympic lifting too, and sprinting and jumping is eccentric, and anything concentric only is a little bit different. This is just something that's been intriguing, is the idea of just the starting strength and you know, turning a lot of muscles on as fast as you can, and that'll ideal. But I guess the coordination is still a little different then. I mean, it's not going to be the same as the stretch shortening. And
yeah, and then there may be an argument for it. I haven't been convinced yet. But that's not to say I'm right. That's just my opinion.
No, sure. No, definitely. I don't have a whole, I mean, part of it's probably the reason I was asked you that question is because I don't have a whole lot of experience in that either. I'm just starting to get, I'm getting started with some things like real high rack pull cleans for swimmers and things like that, and trying to see some things, but not, you know, I haven't really done it with jumpers or sprinters, so I can't say too much myself.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, but yeah, I'm undecided, yeah.
Cool.
And, well, and I think, yeah, some of those exercises, you will get specific adaptation in terms of, you know, high rack pull, you might be getting, you know, massive glute and spinal erector activation, and that might be very applicable to something else. So if that's the best way of doing it and it's concentric only, cool. I'm not writing it off. I still would use that tool if I could see a value in it. But potentially you could do, you know, a mid-thigh pull where you start it at the waist, drop it down to mid-thigh, have an eccentric component, and then pull it. Maybe that's even better. Who knows?
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster. Yeah, I'm sure there's a few different ways to do it and play around with it, and a lot of different ways that athletes would adapt to that. So I'm going to take the next question with something I saw in one of your presentations, and it's something I've heard like Matt Jordan talk about, and something I think is interesting, especially for any strength and conditioning coach or physical preparation coach, and that's the you know, can we do anything in the weight room to influence that dynamic or reactive strength that's in the 0.15 seconds and below category of movement, like sprinting or a long jump takeoff? Is there anything that we can do in the weight room that really can have a good influence on that? I guess maybe outside of eccentric training, the delayed overshoot there.
Yeah. Well, I guess it depends how you look at having a direct impact. Like most sorts of strength training will increase the stiffness of your leg, the stiffness of the leg spring, the compressibility of a leg. And if you know, you've got 150 milliseconds or whatever you've suggested there to apply force. Well, if you have less time damping the force, you know, so for example, of your 150 milliseconds, you could be damping for 100 milliseconds and applying concentric force for 50 milliseconds. If your strength in the gym goes up, maybe you're damping that same amount of impulse, if you like, for 50 milliseconds, then you've got 100 milliseconds to apply force. So any strength training potentially may give you positive adaptations there. That said, you know, as you've sort of alluded to, some modalities lend themselves more to developing that stiffer leg spring, you know, the eccentric, the isometric perhaps is, to an extent as well. So I think we can, but you just got to know why you're doing what you're doing and having that time to prepare it. So, I think, you know, that if you 150 milliseconds, you know, you want fast motor units, so you better be training fast motor units. And the eccentric modality seems to be one modality of getting, you know, a greater abundance of those fast twitch motor units. So maybe there's a place for you could make the argument that you should be using it in your training.
Yeah, I could totally see that. I like the idea of just talking about that stiffer spring and the way that efficiency improves. I mean, yeah, even outside of the whole maybe fine coordination aspect of things, just building stiffer springs being a great adaptation.
Yeah. And with a stiffer spring, you can hit the ground harder and, you know, respond faster. And that's kind of what sprinting is. So,
Yeah. And along those lines too, I didn't have this in the question list, but it kind of made me think about it, is with working with, you know, various athletes who are relying on those contraction times and the stiff springs, are you, when you're doing something like squats or even the eccentric work in squats, is there like a depth that you're, you know, trying, a general depth that you're trying to hit? Are you trying to keep it somewhat specific or general and hitting like parallel depths, or what's the ramification?
No, that's a really good question. And I probably don't. We don't have a definitive answer. I don't have a definitive answer for you there. But sometimes we do a lot of work in that short range, which might be very specific to the event. And certainly later on, you might be doing shorter and faster. But early on, we'll try and develop the muscle quality. I know some of that. You know, the topical stuff that probably Franz Bosch has popularized, and the concept of muscle slack, and, you know, you shouldn't be squatting deep because they just can develop, you know, the slack and yeah, really interesting concept, and a lot of good stuff out there that he's put in there conceptually. It's yet to, from what I can see, to be thoroughly tested. Does it actually occur the way he's describing it? Maybe not. You know, a lot of people that run fast by doing exactly the opposite things to what has been suggested. I don't think it's the be-all and end-all, but it's a really cool idea, and I like that idea of, you know, he's training a lot of hamstring stuff in a back extension mode. Well, what you're describing from a rack pull is perhaps even a better way of doing that, in my opinion, if you're considering that you're going through a short range, the same as he's advocating, train the hamstrings, glutes, and erectors in that short range, specific to sprinting. But you're also doing it in a way which is posturally specific, you're upright. So maybe that's even another step forward in the specificity angle for a runner. I don't know. We use a bit of short, to go back to your question, we use a bit of both. Some specific to the event, but some just general adaptation stuff as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that the muscle slack concept. I've thought about that a lot myself. You know, like, it makes sense. Like, it, and I know from both my own training and working with athletes, like, I felt like every time I deep squat someone for too long, like excessively, I've started to see some diminishment in that real quick static spring. But I've never had a problem doing it for a few weeks at a time, at least not that I can really think of. So maybe similar to eccentric.
I don't think the body is that stupid in some ways. That there is some degree that the body will self-optimize, get enough co-contraction of the muscles around a joint to develop its own joint's stiffness. And so it self-optimizes to the what it has and how it's been trained, would be my guess. And I'm not 100% convinced that's completely true, but, you know, Franz is a very smart man and done some good stuff, but it just doesn't ring true to me that the body would be that stupid.
Yeah, there's a lot of really, really fast, explosive athletes that do squat deep a lot. It's
completely.
It can't be messing with everybody's muscle slack and making them all compliant and not stiff at all. These great athletes who are doing this stuff.
No, I find it hard to believe too. So yeah, I like the idea, and it's good to question your beliefs. And but yeah, who knows.
Yeah. The answer is always probably somewhere in the little bit of the gray zone. But yeah, it's interesting questions to think about for sure. I had a lot of thinking on my part there. Awesome. Cool. So just a few more questions for you, Angus. And great stuff so far. Thanks for those answers. And yeah, even though I almost like the questions the most where the answer isn't definitive, because it just leads to more fun when training the athletes. You know, the case studies and the different types of responses and those types of things.
Yeah, there's always going to be art to coaching, not just science. And that's what, you know, when you have the great coaches that have that feel, that deep understanding and the great eye, you know, and that's where greatness in coaching comes from, I think. Like, you know, they'll understand all that, the science side of it, but also have that sort of innate understanding as well. And we'll try different things, you know, knowing what one athlete brings, they might adapt things, tweak things subtly, and it takes time and years and wisdom, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. So question on the feet. And actually, I really like asking this question to various guests, but what are your thoughts on training the feet, foot strength? Like is there a particular level of foot strength that someone should acquire through special strength methods for sprinting, jumping, those types of things? And method, just general thoughts in that realm.
I think foots, you know, I've been using foot strength with guys pretty much every warm up, and it's just a good, you know, a lot of stuff, bare feet, skipping, variations, toe raises, whatever it might be, and just trying to develop this, you know, sandpit work, whatever it is. And it's, you know, you got to warm up anyway. This stuff is perhaps a bonus, an add on to your training. You know, we know when you're running, it's all very well developing this enormous, you know, power production capacity through your glutes and hamstrings and the muscles in the hip region. If you damp through your feet so much that you can't express it, it's going to be, you can't use it, you know. So it becomes, you know, money not well spent in terms of the training time you have. So I think, and again, this will be individual. Like, you have some people that have, like I was a guy that had very stiff feet, and I would, which is possibly an advantage in some ways, but I was very susceptible to stress fractures. I would get metatarsal stress fractures, you know, every year, pretty much. And you know, probably I was biomechanically inefficient and a whole lot of other things, let's face it. But I probably didn't need to do the foot strength work that the next guy might have needed to do, in hindsight. And so I think there's, you know, horses for courses again, but certainly there are studies which show, and mind you, this is with untrained people, that if you strengthen the toe flexors of the foot, they will run faster. No other training. They will run faster by having stronger feet. So that's pretty cool. And I, you know, I mentioned Franz Bosch before, and I've been to a couple of his seminars, and he mentioned at one, he was talking about some of the Swedish jumpers from the, you know, when the Swedes had that great era, you know, early 2000s, perhaps, you know, you had Kaiser Bergqvist, you had Stefan Holm, Christian Olsen, the Kalursis twins, you had, who else did you have? Hip athlete, having a mental block here.
Oh, I am too, because I was at a Kluft or
Kluft.
Yeah, Karen Kluft. Oh.
Yeah. So you had this great era of amazing athletes, and he was saying, and I, you know, I have not seen this firsthand at all, but he was talking about doing toe raises and bare feet, only your toes in contact with the, you know, step, for example, not the ball of the foot, just the toes, and you try doing that yourself, and it's quite hard. And single leg, even harder. He reckoned they got to the point where they could take their big toe off, use the other four toes, and do toe raises just with the four. And their foot strength and their integrity of that, you know, those, you know, Swedish athletes was something they worked on. You know, I have no idea. I haven't seen it myself, but it sounded pretty cool. And I thought, wow, I wonder if that was one of the keys to that generation of great jumpers and athletes that came out of Sweden. And, I haven't seen anything else to back that up, but it's, so, you know, why not? Sounds like a pretty interesting idea.
Yeah, it probably couldn't hurt too much, at the very least.
No, I wouldn't think it would hurt at all, but you'll certainly get strong feet if you got to that point.
It's interesting that it'd be the, because there's a lot of talk about like the big toe, you know, the connection of the big toe and the glutes and pushing out the big toe. And I like do manual testing on the big toe, and I find usually the athletes, or I work with swimmers a lot, and so whose feet are very floppy and not designed for stiff, you know, sprinting and things. And a lot of times they have weak big toes. I'm wondering why. I mean, I don't disagree with it. I think it makes sense, but why the little toes too? I guess maybe just well-roundedness as well. They're always pushing out the big toe.
Yeah, I mean they all probably have some propulsive, moderate, a tiny bit of propulsive force to the whole system, I guess. So, I mean he obviously would not neglect training the big toe,
No, sure,
but
yeah.
they were so good that they could also do that. So I just thought it was kind of a cool idea, kind of cool quote, and I was quite intrigued by it at the time.
Yeah, I think so. Well, shoot, I'm gonna try it for a few months and get back to you. See what happens here. I'm
Forward
intrigued.
to hearing.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster. One last question for you. And this was something I also saw in your presentation. It was really intriguing to me. And you talked about using methods like a farmer's walk, or almost like a farmer's walk run for building stiffness and maybe like the core, hips, or those, that type of thing.
I kind of, this was just a concept that I have no real evidence to support this. This is just me thinking laterally, I guess. One of the things I've been looking at in the last few years is looking at some of these papers which show. If you think of books, riding a bike, a Wingate sort of test on a bike, it's concentric only muscle power. And if you take a group of athletes and you put them on a Wingate bike and then you sprint test them over 40 meters, say, you'd expect that the powerful athletes on the bike would be the fast runners, right? But to me, that sort of makes sense. As it turns out, the correlation is really, really poor. It's something like, R squared is, in quite a few of these studies, is under 0.3. So you're only sharing 30% of the variance and ability between those events, which has seemed really low to me. You would have thought a fast explosive guy on the bike would be a fast explosive runner. And so if you're getting this poor correlation in some of these studies, I was kind of thinking, well, we spend all this bloody time training away doing, squats and trying to develop muscle power, if you like, for a sprinter. Maybe the transfer is pretty limited, and you're always hearing examples of guys that can run 9.9 and they barely do weights, or there's all these stories. So maybe it's not the be all and end all, and maybe what we're trying to develop from running, from lifting, is a stiff leg spring. And I just sort of thought, well, farmer's walk, it's first of all it's gait, so it's relatively specific to running. If you brought it into a run and you've got 100 pounds in each hand, and you're sprinting 20 meters. With that, your impact forces are very high. Obviously, the ground contact times are a lot longer than in sprinting, but it's a hell of a lot closer than squatting is. And I haven't got any evidence to support that. That was just a concept that I was when I did that presentation. I thought, oh, we're trying this at the time. It seemed to make sense. I might be completely barking up the wrong tree, and I'm yet to be convinced either way, but it was just a concept that I thought was worth investigating, given we were getting such poor correlations with, once you were quite strong, any more strength didn't seem to add anything to your sprint performance. Or certainly not measurable changes anyway, or easily measurable changes, I should say.
Yeah, well, I always like the lateral thinking answers, because I mean it makes me think. That's what happened when I saw that that exercise. Like, yeah, that kind of makes sense with what you're trying to get at. And I was gonna ask you too, like, what I mean, yeah, because once an athlete gets strong enough in the weight room and working with high level athletes, like they always want to be improving in something. Like they have a hard time just you saying, okay, you're strong enough, just do this. You know, it's the same as it's always been. It's like you're always trying to find something better. And I imagine, yeah.
I think you're right, and if there's something, you make up a new personal best or personal record for that event. Oh, what's your 40 meter time with a bloody couple of dumbbells? And hey, it's all of a sudden training's exciting again. Is it relevant? I don't know. But I think along that theme, where you're talking about, when you get these elite athletes, there's always more there in the technique as well. And if you allow more time, you develop some of the specific strength qualities and that relate to the event you're training for. You're going to get more bang for your buck there with an elite athlete than just trying to squat another 50 pounds. That may not be any use, and it might be a lot of energy cost to get another 50 pounds. So, you know, I think going back to something which is highly specific, which is not, you know, and a lot of people, because we get stuck in the weight room with this, you know, clean squats, bench press mentality kind of thing that, which you know, bear very little resemblance to running, jumping, throwing really, and that's what we're, the actual end goal was, to throw further, jump further, run faster. You got to keep going back to the end goal and thinking, well, how can I subtly improve? Where am I weak in my jump? You know, what joint angle? Can I specifically train that joint angle? And my feet mushing out? You know, find out, analyze your event, go back to the training, and after that critiquing of the event, try and improve your training to that end.
Yeah, the more farther along you get, the more like really the closer that looking glass has to get with what you're exactly trying to do.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, hey, Angus, that's all the time. We had all the questions I had for you today. But thanks so much for being on the show and taking the time all the way over there in New Zealand. Really appreciate it, man.
My pleasure. Yeah, that's been good. Enjoyed it.
All right, that does it for another episode. Thanks so much for tuning in with us today. We really appreciate your viewership, and we hope you learned something from the episode. I certainly learned a lot. Again, please visit our sponsor at simplyfaster.com, suppliers of high-end speed training technology, such as the Freelap Timing System, the Speedmat, and as we've chatted about, the K-Box, which is definitely one of the most efficient and probably the most effective way to deliver powerful eccentric loads to your athletes. That just makes it so easy, and the loads are devastatingly powerful, and in the hands of a great coach, it's an awesome tool. So check them out and see what they have to offer there. Also, if you loved what you listened to, or even if you didn't, it'd be awesome if you left us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Help get the word out of what we're doing here. So until then, we'll see you all next week.